identity shapes everything. Who we are, who we become, and where we belong. But the British, hungry for power, twisted that identity to divide India, carving deep lines through religion, caste, and languages. Divide and rule. The empire's oldest trick etched in Indian history. He is here to peel back the layers.
How are you today?
Not too bad. Just been outside for a bit. Good to see you.
Sound ready? And action!
Politician, intellectual, and a tireless advocate of post-colonial truth. Dr. Shashi Tharoor, welcome again.
Good to see you, Ranjun.
Now, Reddit users are debating whether British even use the divide and rule policy. They say there's hardly any evidence of that. But Shashi, really, how do you respond to that, given the fact that the fault lines still exist? I mean, look at the recent India-Pakistan tensions, conflict, war, whatever we may want to call it.
Look, I mean, this question of whether there was divide and rule is like asking sort of whether the sun rises in the east. It was so basic to the British approach after the revolt of 1857. Which saw the unity of people across a religious divide, both Hindus and Muslims, serving in the British forces rose up unitedly. The princely states who were both Hindu-ruled and Muslim-ruled also rose up together. And the British were just horrified. They put it down ruthlessly, butchered people. But at the end of it all, they said, listen, we've also lost a lot of lives. We can't risk this again. Lord Elphinstone actually wrote a note, saying divide et impera was the ancient Roman maxim and it shall be ours. Actually, it was wrong. It wasn't a Roman maxim. It was Macedonian because it was Philip II of Macedon who came up with that line. But divide et impera means divide and rule. And it became a conscious policy of the British to separate the major communities by making them believe that their interests were incompatible with each other's. So there was a serious effort made to encourage a separate feeling amongst the Muslim community. And this in particular was manifested repeatedly. I can give you just two examples. There are 100 of them I can give you. One was the deliberate decision to partition Bengal in 1905 into a Muslim-majority province and a Hindu-majority province, even though Bengal was culturally and politically united forever, practically. What do the British do? They went to the Nawab of Dhaka, who was a British-educated Muslim noble, and said, you know, we want you to call for a separate province. And he said, this is utter nonsense. We're all one people. You can't do this. So they slipped him £100,000 as an incentive to change his song, and then he supported this, and partition happened. In the end, it was undone. But the point is not that. The point is it was conscious, create a separate sense of sentiment. The other example was, again, in the same decade, the so-called Minto Mori reforms, when they actually started fulfilling very hypocritically and very, very reluctantly their public promise since the days of Queen Victoria to gradually introduce progressive self-governance in India. The Minto Mori reforms were ways of basically allowing some elected Indian representation. What do? They created a very small electorate, less than 5% of the population. But even there, they created separate electorates for Muslims, where only Muslims could be candidates, only Muslims could vote. So they would feel, look, we are different. And the idea was very simple. When you create political representation where you can only appeal to a particular set of voters, identities get entrenched all the more. Right? So if Muslims are only voting for Muslim candidates to represent Muslim interests, then you define Muslim interests as separate from those of everybody else. It was a very, very deliberate policy. They didn't have separate electorates for the Jews of Golders Green in London, but they did it in India. It was absolutely deliberate colonial policy. And we've seen this throughout the rest of the waning decades of the British Empire in India. It was to accentuate the sense of separation and difference, which ultimately culminated in the tragic horrors of partition that has, of course, led us to 77 years of unremitting hostility, wasteful defense expenditure, four or five wars, and the most recent crisis you just mentioned, Ranjit. So I'm afraid the original sin is right at the feet of the British.
Now, we also want to talk about the Government of India Act of 1935. Do you think that made the Hindu-Muslim divide more permanent?
Yeah, so they did it throughout. These separate electorates began in 1906 or 1907 with the Minto Morley reforms and continued right up through the Government of India Act 1935. So at no stage could ever there have been a sense of united political interests because everything was communally divided. Separate electorates for Muslims, separate electorates for Sikhs, separate electorates for Hindus, separate electorates for Christians. In the end of the day, you were creating a situation where you were gradually eking out what you call democracy. By the way, even the very last election conducted under British rule, 1946, only 10% of the population was eligible to vote. It never was universal adult franchise. It was based on education, property qualifications, income, and all these sorts of... So it was only an elite that was voting, never really masses. But even then, separate electorates. So educated Muslims who had Hindu friends and educated Hindus who had Muslim friends couldn't vote for each other. That was the kind of situation the British delivered. So the absolute hardening of political identities and therefore political interests along communal lines was a basic fact of British colonial policy.
And also the hardening of the fault lines between Hindus and Muslims. It often gets talked about, but not the caste division. Now, there's a lot of buzz online that British, in fact, formalized the Indian caste system. Is there any evidence to that?
Yeah, so caste existed. Let's not deny the fact that the notion of caste had existed going back in many, many ways to the whole Varnashrama dharma of the Vedic era, where people were broadly classified according to their professions. But there was also a certain fluidity to caste. In the old days, people would even escape their caste by moving to another region where people would not know where they'd come from, who they were. People would acquire skills that gave them a profession that changed their caste. You could come from a very humble background, become a soldier. And as a soldier, you could enter a warrior caste, especially by moving around. So this fluidity has been fairly well documented. These kinds of mobilities that took place within the caste system, these became much more difficult because the British believed in classification and categorization and putting people into boxes as an instrument of their control and their rule. The census, the map, the museum, all of these would seem very innocent things today. Everything was actually designed to consolidate colonial control. And the amusing thing is that when you look at it today, you see, how can a census be just counting people? But how do you count people? You make them define who they are in the sense of rigid identities, and then they're boxed into those identities, and you grant benefits, even descriptions and categories on the basis of those identities. So suddenly, the census becomes an instrument of solidifying a system. The caste system is something impermeable, something you can't graduate between or among, something that boxes you into an identity. All of this was, yes, solidified by the British system. The British also had this incredibly, I don't know how to say it, what adjective to use. I suppose the politest word would be racist, way of describing entire sets of people according to their convenience. So there is an entire British idea of the martial races. Martial races were the people they considered fit to be warriors. And so, for example, a lot of invasion used to come to India from the northwest. You had hardy fighting people, for example, amongst the Pathans and the Punjabis. They were considered martial races. The Bengalis were considered effete, Babu, clerical material. I mean, it's this kind of racist classification. Similarly, they had this deeply offensive classification of criminal tribes. Entire groups of people were listed as criminal tribes. That is, if you're born into that tribe, you're automatically considered a criminal by default. It's like, you know, the biblical notion that man is born in sin and man is a sinner and has to be redeemed by God. Somehow you're born into some tribe, the Pindaris, for example, you are a criminal tribe. They were actually classified in the census as criminal tribes. Now, this kind of thing is a British invention. We certainly never had it before.
Now, Shashi, British journalist Nick Ferrari, he says that imperialism actually reduced fights between warring groups in India. Just that idea that had before British came, there was non-stop fighting between Indians, no alliances, no cooperation.
Look, we've talked about this earlier. India was, with the decline of the Mughal Empire past Aurangzeb, there were more and more of these different fiefdoms, principalities, which were indeed fighting with each other. But, you know, you don't need the British to come and restore law and order. They did. But instead of them, somebody else would have if they weren't around. I mean, as I mentioned to you, the Marathas were expanding their domains very successfully. They had actually conquered a number of these warring principalities, subdued them, appointed their own Peshwas, their own rulers. There was a long period of time when the Mughal emperor was essentially a hostage of the Marathas. They kept him in his throne. He was the emperor in name, and he was issuing the decrees and the firmans, but the Marathas were telling him what to write. So instead of British restoring law and order, the Marathas would have restored law and order. All I'm saying is societies evolve historically in a normal way. To give the British credit for having established an empire and ensured that law and order was maintained is to say nothing that could not have been said of any other empire, also establishing law and order and also maintaining it. If you are ruling a place, you want to control it. So India was full of warring kingdoms, let's say, in the early part of the 18th century. By mid-18th century, Marathas controlled a lot of it. By late 18th century, if there was no colonialism, and by certainly beginning of 19th, you might have well seen India as a largely Maratha domain. It didn't happen that way. Instead, it became a largely British domain. But whoever had established their dominance would, of course, have wanted to maintain law and order. Doesn't every empire do that? Why give any special credit for the British? I mean, they happened to be the ones who came along at that time and who prevailed.
So, have you heard of this theory called the Stranger King? It's a theory, it's trending on X. Basically, the idea that an outsider steps in where there's some sort of conflict, acts neutral, and then ends up dominating and exploiting. Now, some would say that India had a Stranger King situation with the British back in the days.
So, we've had outsiders coming in, both in situations where they were overcoming united empires. For example, when Babur marched in and conquered Ibrahim Shah Lodi, we weren't a bunch of warring kingdoms and principalities. The Lodi Empire was a pretty solid across northern India empire, but Babur came and defeated it. So we've had that kind of stranger king. There you've got a stranger king without the benefit of warring principalities. You've got the stranger king coming in and taking advantage of divisions and warring principalities and asserting his rule, both with the British and at different times with the Marathas. It's not that the Marathas overcame any united kingdoms either. They also came in and conquered. So when you have a Maratha ruling in Tanjavur in Tamil Nadu, he is, in a sense, as much of a stranger to the people of Tanjavur as, say, a British king would be in Bengal. It's an interesting idea. I don't think it's a profound contribution that, yes, where there is disorder and disunity, a larger force can come and establish itself and prevail. I mean, to my mind, that's what happened. Whether you're suggesting through the question that it needed an outsider to come and make us all see the light of reason and get along better with each other, there I would find that very self-serving of if it's a British person making that argument, because I think that whether it had come organically from within, whether it had been an Indian from one part of India or another part of India, it still would have been preferable to many of us to seeing this particular person from outside. And I'll tell you why. The Mughals came in, as I said, as stranger kings. They stayed, they married, they assimilated, and even if they exploited or looted or plundered, they spent the products of their loot and plundered exploitation in India. They created great Indian architecture, great Indian culture, jewelry, artisan, handicrafts, textiles, everything, right? The British came as a stranger king. They also pacified, they also ruled, they also maintained law and order. But what they looted, drained, and exploited, they took to England. 26 to 30% of India's GDP every year was being sent off to England to benefit the people there, not to be spent in India to benefit the people of India. That is the difference. The stranger king in the Mughal example became a local. The stranger king in the British example stayed foreign forever.
Shashi, even after the British left, it seems like we couldn't really undo the damage. Was this divide permanent?
If you mean the divide between India and Pakistan, it is apparently permanent.
But also the fault lines.
But if you mean Hindu-Muslim, no, I don't believe it's permanent. I think we made a very conscious effort in the first decades after independence to reject the notion of the two-nation theory. The two-nation theory that argued that these were two separate nations and had to live separately was a very self-serving argument by those who wanted power in the name of Pakistan. It's also a very bigoted argument to argue that if you belong to a particular religion, you can't live in a political arrangement with people of another religion is a level of bigotry that's extremely difficult to accept. However, that was the bigotry, that was the argument that animated the creation of Pakistan. Now, when Pakistan was created, the Indian Constituent Assembly actually debated the question of whether now they've created a state for Muslims of India, shall we create a state for Hindus of India? And it was overwhelmingly rejected in the debates. People saying we have created a state for everybody, our freedom struggle was a struggle for everybody. How can we accept the logic that had divided the nation? That logic itself is flawed. And so they rejected the two-nation theory and they said our country will be a country for everyone. And they wrote a constitution that treats everyone as equal, irrespective of their religion, their caste, their language, their region, their place of birth, their color. It was irrelevant. You could be Indian whoever you were. Very interestingly, in the 1950s, there were a couple of very famous Englishmen, white Englishmen, who renounced British citizenship and took Indian citizenship because of their commitment to this ideal. The scientist J.B.S. Haldane, the anthropologist Vere Elwin, many other such examples. My own professor of history at St. Stephen's College was a white Australian called David Baker, who fought for years. Indians couldn't understand why this white guy wants to become Indian. But it was an identification with what we stood for, what our freedom movement had fought for, and for the idea that ultimately, if you're Indian, you're all equal, you all have the same rights.
So some, both offline and online, say that equality may be in the book, but even today, we have politicians, and for them, religion is in the center of their politics. Why?
I think it varies. Frankly, religion has become, like caste, an instrument of political mobilization. That is, I appeal to you for votes. Now, in the democratic theory of the democratic world in general, I should be appealing to you for votes on the basis of your interests. Why is it good for you to vote for me? What will I do for you, right? Now, there are many bases in which you can do it. I represent your class interests. You are working class, I am working class, I'll fight for your rights, vote for me. I can say, I represent your business interests. I'm in favor of free enterprise, I'll remove laws that are standing in the way of your business, vote for me. But I can also say, I am from your caste, I'm like you. Vote for me so that people like you can be in power. Or I can say, I'm from your religion. Vote for me because people of our religion are going to call the shots. Now, what you think works for you to mobilize votes is what animates democratic politics. And one of the sad truisms about any democracy is that most politicians can't think beyond the next election.
Now, there's a popular debate online that while Hinduism is an ancient religion, but we weren't always called Hindus. Now, how did that label come about in the 19th century?
We didn't have a name for the faith because it was the only faith. In fact, if at all there was a notion, it was the eternal faith, the Sanatan Dharma, everlasting, ever true. It was one way of looking at life and creation. And because that one way embraced all possible ways, there wasn't a need to label it. Then came the foreigners, right? So they came, they stopped at the River Indus, this big, broad expanse of water. The Persians were the first to have to find a name for the people on the other side of the Indus and who couldn't pronounce the word Sindhu, the Indian name for Indus. They couldn't say the S and therefore they said Hindu. And the people on the other side of the Indus were all called Hindus. In other words, we were given a name for our self-definition by foreigners.
Now, there's also a lot of confusion online with respect to the usage of Hinduism and Hindutva. This is the New Age confusion. Could you clear that out once and for all?
It's actually very easy because the person who came up with the concept of Hindutva was a man called Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, V.D. Savarkar, who wrote a book called The Essentials of Hindutva in 1923. And he particularly said that Hindutva is not just Hindu. Hindutva literally means Hindu-ness. Tva means ness, N-E-S-S, okay? So Hindutva is Hindu-ness. But he said that Hindu-ness is beyond Hinduism as a religion. It relates to the ethnicity of the people. Don't forget in the 1920s when he was writing, there was a lot of race theory about. You had the German, the Nazis talking about the Aryan race versus the Jewish race, and eugenics was being talked about. And so Savarkar and many of his followers talked about the Hindu race as something going beyond the practice of the religion. It was an ethnic identity for them. Now, Hindutva and those who believed in it and practiced it were treating it as a political doctrine. So Hinduism is a religion. Hindutva is a political doctrine anchored in a notion of ethnicity.
Shashi, how far have we come since the debate over colonial interference in religion and India's secularism? Where do we really stand today?
Oh, the debate's an ongoing one, and sometimes I fear that it's going to be going on forever, because I grew up in an India where secularism was taken for granted, even though, strictly speaking, it's the wrong word. Because if you look up an English dictionary, secularism refers to the absence of religion, to distancing yourself from religion. And that was never on the cards in a country like India, where even in a recent Pew poll, 97% of the population said they considered themselves religious and their religion mattered to them. By far number one in the world. Even countries where there are official state religions, which there isn't in India, even in those countries, it's 70%, 60%, you know, people considering themselves religious. In India, it's 97. So we are a country where religion is so deeply in our soil that pretty much everyone identifies with a notion of religious belief. But rather than secular, I would have preferred the word pluralist. Because I myself come from a Hindu background, a Hindu faith, a Hindu conviction, which to my mind was brilliantly explained by the great Swami Vivekananda in the 1890s. When he talked about Hinduism as a faith that teaches not just tolerance, but acceptance. What is the idea of acceptance? The tolerant king, whom we all are taught is a good king because he's tolerant, right? He indulges you. No, the tolerant king is actually a very patronizing character. He's saying, I have the truth, you are in error, but I will indulge you in your right to be wrong. That's all the tolerant king is doing. But Vivekananda says Hinduism is much more than that. Hinduism is about acceptance. Says, I believe I have the truth. You believe you have the truth. I will respect your truth. Please respect my truth. And that is the premise on which the Indian state was founded. We'll have multiple religions. They'll all be allowed to flourish. In fact, there is no constitutional obligation for the state to stay out of religion. The state can help. State runs temple boards in all parts of India. It used to subsidize the Hajj pilgrimage for Muslims. It used to give grants and tax exemptions to Christian schools and so on and so forth. It's not that the state has to stay away from religion, but it encourages and allows all religions to flourish. We used to have a specific thing called entertainment tax, where if you went to see a movie, in addition to the ticket price, you paid a particular tax for being entertained. Funny. That entertainment tax used to be waived by the government when the film promoted national integration. What's the national integration? You have a movie like Amar Akbar Antony, where three toddlers are separated and they're brought up by three different foster parents. One is a Hindu, one is a Muslim, one is a Christian, and they get together in the end, they fight the bad guys, and they discover each other's are brothers. Great story, all communities together, no entertainment tax. That was the culture, right? So it was really very much the thinking that that we wanted to promote the sense of brotherhood amongst all of us, irrespective of religious differences. Will we come back to that era? In our current politics, it seems difficult because our current politics is much more religiously divisive. But I still believe at heart that in the end, we will get there because we're just simply too accustomed to living with each other, playing with each other, sharing, you know, classrooms and lives and careers and cricket teams and so on with each other. How can we really be separated by politicians?
It has been truly enlightening. Thank you very much.
Really enjoyed it. Divide and rule was their weapon to fracture us. But India's strength has always been its unity in diversity. Our languages, faiths and cultures, these are not fault lines, but the ties that bind our real strength. And we must never forget that.